Ladies, gentlemen, and students, good evening. Thank you for coming to this debate this evening. My name is Philip Hurst. I'm Director of International and Public Law at the law firm of Ashurst. Now, the names sound the same, but I assure you there is no connection. Mr. William Ashurst founded the firm in 1822. Tonight, we are going to engage in a debate. And despite the reaction when the two speakers came in, there are, in fact, two sides to this debate. And you will hear both sides, whether you want to or not. Let me first tell you the structure of how we are going to conduct this. The first speaker will be Dr. Simpson, who will speak for 15 minutes or so. He will be followed by Professor Greenwood, who will speak for an hour or two. And then there will be 3 minutes of questions, and Professor Greenwood will be declared the winner.
You've read the script very well.
No, in fact, Professor Greenwood will speak for a similar length of time. We will then take questions from the audience, but we will take the questions in groups of three so as to ensure that we get as wide a spectrum of questions as possible. And we hope to conclude by no later than 7:30. Now, before I ask Dr. Simpson to commence the proceedings, let me tell you who we are. When I say we, I mean Ashurst. We have very few LSE graduates amongst our 800 or so lawyers, and that's a position that we want to change. LSE is a very, very fine law school, and we'd like more of you. And that's part of the reason why we wanted to sponsor this tonight, and I'm very grateful to the Law Alumni Group for being invited to do this. We have our largest office in the City of London, but we have offices across Europe, in Asia, and in North America. We are, for the most part, a blue-chip corporate law firm, but in addition, we have a very active practice in public international law, and I'm not embarrassed to say that one of our preferred advocates, whenever we seek senior counsel, is sitting to my right this evening, and he has advised our clients on a number of occasions. That's not the only reason why I said we will declare him the winner. Those of you who are still contemplating employment in one of the top law firms in London, you may obtain our graduate recruitment brochure from the front desk, or you can speak to my colleague Jonathan Hills, who is where? Johnny, where are you? Ah, up there. My God. He's in the middle of a bevy of students up there. So there's no point my pointing you out, is there? My colleague Jonathan Hills, who will also be able to help you. So, enough propaganda. At least enough propaganda from us. Now, what about propaganda from the government and the opposition? This debate, in part, is prompted by a scurrilous piece in the Grawniad by Robin Cook, who said, in reference to the Attorney General, on October the 15th, that in relation to the legal opinion for the invasion of Iraq, the Attorney General himself appeared unsure of his ground. But his dilemma was eased by the suggestion from Downing Street that he outsourced the drafting of his opinion to a law professor with a record of support for war. Now, whether or not that's libelous. As a result, the nation went to war against the advice of Whitehall's experts in international law and on the strength of an opinion from a professor at the LSE. Now, that professor is not identified. He may be identified before the end of the evening, I don't know. But that has been the spur for this debate, and I invite Dr. Simpson to lead us off. Thank you.
I think we should just take a vote, really, on this film. Do we need the debate? Well, let me thank, first of all, the LIC Alumni Society and Ashurst for sponsoring the debate, and more importantly, the dinner we'll enjoy afterwards. We had imagined this, Chris and I, when we discussed this debate, that it would be a sort of U.S.-style presidential debate with a podium here and a podium over there. And I saw myself in the sort of John Kennedy role in this debate with Chris possibly in the Richard Nixon role. But it occurs to me that if this really was a U.S. presidential debate, it would probably be highly advisable to lose it on the basis that if... on the basis if you lose the debate, you win the election, of course. But in a way, I feel in a sense that I've already lost the debate. We went to war, after all, against Iraq. So don't let Chris present himself as being on the side of the Mavericks, or far less the Angels in this case, because he's on the side of the powers that took us to war. Whereas I'm on the side of the Mavericks here. And in a way, we did, of course, go or engage in an illegal war, which I think did damage the rule of law to a certain extent. And I'll speak about that later in my presentation. But there were good things came out of this war in relation to law. And one of them was that international law was absolutely central to the debate about legality in the Second Gulf War. People talked about international law. International law was on the middle pages of The Guardian virtually every day, possibly The Telegraph too. It was all over the mainstream media, and I don't remember that being the case in previous wars. So I found that enormously encouraging. I remember being in Florida in February 2003, and I was traveling along minding my own business on a bus when suddenly this debate broke out on the bus. I thought, this is American democracy in action. And these little old ladies were arguing about the legality of the war. And I was keeping myself to myself very much. And the bus driver, this very burly ex-GI, as it turned out, had heard my accent as I bought the ticket and turned to me during this debate and said, "So, you're English, are you?" Yeah. "You're English. Are you with us or are you against us?" So I'll let you know if I'm with him or against him. 3 points to begin with. First of all, we have to distinguish between two bodies of law here. The law on the use of force, which determines whether going to war or the decision to go to war is lawful or not, and the laws that continue to operate within the context of a war, whether that war is lawful or unlawful. So whether one is engaged in an entirely lawful war under the UN Charter or an entirely illegal war, it's critically important under international law that one conducts oneself within the laws of war, in other words, the international humanitarian laws of war. It's also possible, of course, to engage in an illegal war under the UN Charter and yet continue to act in compliance with the Geneva Convention. So I think that distinction is very important to begin with. A second distinction. We are debating the legal position tonight, but there are a whole number of other debates we might have. We might have a debate about the strategy for war. We might have a debate about the morality of war. We might have a debate based on religious or spiritual values. After all, there were archbishops and popes. There's only one pope, but there were archbishops and a pope. There were once two popes, but there's just one pope now, debating this issue all over the newspapers for a long time. Now, Prime Minister Blair, in his Sedgefield speech about 9 months ago, called for the end of the Westphalian system of international law. And I took this to be an implicit admission that the war had been unlawful. I felt that the Prime Minister was saying, look, the war may have been unlawful, but that's not my fault. That's international law's fault. It's time to change the law. And many people have pointed to a sort of failure of law and institutions in this particular case, that the Security Council somehow didn't work because it failed to authorize war. On the other hand, one could say the Security Council did work because it at least attempted to constrain the great powers from acts of unilateralism. But whichever view you take, this is, in a way, a project of law reform. It's fine to argue about changes to the law. What we're arguing about tonight is the law as it exists now and as it existed on March the 20th. In my view, it wasn't a problem with legal institutions or organizations that got us into this war. It was a failure of politics. And I just want to take us back to the starting point of all this, which was a meeting, of course, between the U.S. Ambassador April Galsby and Saddam Hussein just before the war broke out in 1990. There's a transcript now going around of this discussion in which she basically says that Kuwait is an Arab-to-Arab matter and that the United States does not have a view on Iraq's behavior towards Kuwait. The transcript then contains the immortal sentence, "Saddam Hussein smiles," in brackets. I wonder if he's still smiling. Bad politics got us into this mess, not bad institutions. Three things happened on March the 20th, 2003. I celebrated my 40th birthday. Secondly, we went to war against Iraq. And thirdly, the United States and the United Kingdom sent some letters to the Security Council describing why they had reporting that they had indeed gone to war with Iraq and describing the various justifications for that war. And those justifications were somewhat different in the case of the United States as opposed to the United Kingdom. I'll say something about those differences in a moment, but I think it's important to be aware that there is a difference of opinion amongst the coalition of the willing on the particular emphasis to place on different justifications in relation to force. The law. First of all, the UN Charter prohibits the use of force under Article 2.4. The Nuremberg Tribunal declared aggression to be a crime. Article 2.3 of the Charter insists that states settle their differences using peaceful methods. The Nicaragua case confirms that the prohibition on the use of force is a high-level norm under international law. But there are exceptions. Lawyers love exceptions. And this time there are two, possibly three exceptions. One is that states may use force in self-defense when subject to an armed attack under Article 51 of the UN Charter. Secondly, states may use force when they are authorized to do so by the Security Council. And third, though I think this is highly dubious, Chris is much more enthusiastic about this idea than I am, there's the idea that states can use force to protect vulnerable populations overseas. In other words, the idea of humanitarian intervention. I'm going to set aside humanitarian intervention for the time being because it wasn't really used as a justification for going to war. It was used as an ex post facto rationalization for that war when those weapons of mass destruction weren't found. But it wasn't used as a prior justification for war. So let's start with the United States position. Over the years, the United States has tended to favor the self-defense argument, I think because it leaves the U.S. less beholden to the United Nations, an organization which doesn't, I think, find a great deal of favor within the Bush administration. And because self-defense is more in keeping with something I want to call Texan international law. And Texan international law is a style of law that emphasizes the unreliability of institutions, the presence of outlaws, the need for self-help, and the idea that the world is a very, very dangerous place. So, the Bush Doctrine. Now, the preamble to the authorization for the use of force says, the risk that the current Iraqi regime will employ weapons of mass destruction to launch a surprise attack against the United States. There are two cases in which states can use force in self-defense. One is if they're actually attacked, if there is a physical armed attack, a cross-border use of force. Second is the doctrine of anticipatory self-defense, where there is an imminent threat of attack, leaving no choice of means, no moment for deliberation, and an overwhelming necessity for response, as the Caroline case has it. The United States wants to develop a third norm of self-defense, which I'll call precautionary self-defense or preventative war. The idea that you get your retaliation in first. There's a problem with this. Let's imagine if India used this norm in its relations with Pakistan, or Pakistan used this norm in its relations with India. On this view, you might say Iraq had a better claim to use force against the United States on March the 20th, 2003, than the United States did against Iraq on the same date. It doesn't sound like a prescription for peace. There are precedents. In 1948, in Operation Broiler, the United States envisaged launching a preemptive nuclear attack on the Soviet Union. In 1984, George Shultz, Ronald Reagan's Secretary of State, developed the Shultz Doctrine, which was a doctrine of preventative war. In 1948, George Orwell was writing a book on a small Scottish island about perpetual war, called 1984. The Soviets had their preventative wars. Indeed, one could say that Osama bin Laden is both consequence and cause of preventative war doctrine. Collective security now. This is the UK position. And here we go back to the UN Charter and what Roosevelt called the four policemen model. The idea that these four policemen would run the planet, engage in force, and destroy outlaws. The fifth policeman was the French. Roosevelt didn't believe the French were a great power and wanted to exclude them from the council. And how they regret the decision to allow the French back into the council again in 1945. The UK position, I think, can be located within four separate arguments around collective security. And I just want to go through those very, very briefly. One is the idea that you can use force to enforce Security Council resolutions that don't themselves specifically or explicitly authorize force. So this is the idea of using force to enforce resolutions. The second argument is the implied authorization argument, that somehow you can imply into the terms of resolutions that merely condemn states an authorization to use force. That if you've got enough of these resolutions that imply a use of force, then indeed you have what adds up to an authorization to use force. A third argument, I think this gets us closer to the British government's position, is that in Resolution 687, just after the Gulf War, the UN imposed a peace treaty on Iraq. And since Iraq has breached that peace treaty, there is no peace between Iraq and the Allies, and therefore there can be a resumption of hostilities. The fourth argument, and I think this is closest to the British government's position, is what's sometimes called the golden thread argument, or the revival argument. And this is the idea that a string of resolutions from Resolution 678 in 1991 through 687, imposing peace on Iraq in 1991, right through to Resolution 1441, in some ways produce authorization to use force. 1441 declares Iraq to be in material breach of 687. 687 is a peace treaty that recalls 678. And 678 authorizes force. So you see, it's an extraordinarily clever and wrong-headed argument, because it traces this very neat line back through the resolutions. There are some problems, and I'll finish with those problems. There's just not enough in these resolutions to sustain the argument. 1441 makes it absolutely clear that Iraq will be given a second chance. Resolution 1441 makes it quite clear that the Security Council shall remain seized of the matter. Resolution 1441 does not explicitly authorize force. This is a very serious matter. We need very explicit authorizations. Resolution 687 indeed does recall 678, but it recalls a whole bunch of other resolutions too. Resolution 687 insists that the Security Council shall remain in control of the situation. In other words, the Security Council will decide whether Iraq is in breach. Not a coalition of the willing. The Security Council, that's what it says in the resolutions, and I believe in reading the resolutions. And finally, the lodestar itself, Resolution 678. This is the one resolution that does authorize war, but it authorized it in 1991. And it authorized it in relation to the liberation of Iraq, albeit with a nod to international peace and security. Indeed, it authorizes a coalition cooperating with the government of Kuwait to use all necessary means. That doesn't sound like an authorization for the United States and the United Kingdom to use force against Iraq 13 years later without Kuwait. Resolution 678 makes it clear that the invasion was only to free Kuwait. I didn't say that. Colin Powell did. And he said it in 1991 in his biography, A Line in the Sand. Colin Powell finds himself in agreement with the Pope and Kofi Annan on this matter. That's quite a combination. Now, in reviving 678, the coalition and its advisors, I think, have tried to revive a corpse. I looked up the word necromancy in the Oxford English Dictionary, and it's defined as dealings with the dead. Dealings with the dead as a way of producing magic. That perfectly describes this revival argument in relation to 678. I think I might finish there, actually.
Thank you, Gary, for that. For that highly amusing, if insubstantial, opening statement. As somebody who was transported to the colonies for 25 years in an earlier part of my life, I should point out that there is a fundamental flaw that I would have expected Gary, who spent several years in the colonies in Victoria, to have taken account of, and that is that there were three countries that invaded Iraq. The third country was Australia. And Mr. Howard has just been re-elected for a record fourth term, which no doubt says something about the mood of Australians. It's a pleasure now to introduce Professor Chris Greenwood, whom you all know as the convener of the Law Department here at the LSE. And he will now put the opposite view to that proposed by Gary. Chris, thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I would like to begin by paying tribute to my learned friend Dr. Simpson's advocacy just then. It was, I thought, a remarkably courageous display of advocacy at the expense of his convener, and leaves me in no doubt whatever who is going to be lecturing on the new registered land conveyancing course, which some of you may like to know will run on Saturday evenings next year. We've learnt a great deal from what he said, that vivid reminder of the old saying that you should try everything once, except necromancy and Morris dancing. The notion that there is an entirely separate Texan international law, and the fact that the main thing to do if you're sitting on your own in a small Scottish island is to write a book about the end of the world. It's probably the most optimistic subject you can consider in those circumstances. Now, before I turn to the subject of Iraq, I should, I'm afraid, make a personal disclaimer. Whether I am indeed the warmongering professor from the LSE identified by Robin Cook is not for me to say. Doubtless Robin Cook has his own views on that subject. But it is no secret that I did act for the government over various matters connected with Iraq. I must therefore make it clear that anything I say this evening are my own views and are not to be attributed to the government. And also that I'm afraid if any of you thought I was going to be tremendously open and frank with you about what I said to the government, forget it. I cannot, of course, say anything about what advice I may or may not have given to anyone, whether it's the government or any other client. Now, Gerry Simpson has presented some pretty weighty charges against the UK, the USA, and, of course, Australia, which took part in the coalition operations against Iraq. Fortunately, we can dispose of some of the counts in that indictment right at the outset. We can get rid, first of all, of preemptive self-defence, because there was no reliance on a right of preemptive self-defence in this case. As the Attorney General told the House of Lords in April this year in a debate, it has never been the position of the government that the military action against Iraq was legally justified on grounds of preemptive self-defence. And the legal advisor to the United States State Department, William Taft, has said the same thing in an article. We can also, I think, dispose of humanitarian intervention, although perhaps with a little more care. Neither government relied on humanitarian intervention as the justification for their actions, nor, with respect, have they reintroduced it as some kind of ex post facto justification. The legality of the use of force against Iraq must, of course, be judged by reference to what the position was at the time that that use of force took place. It cannot be justified retrospectively, any more than a justification can be retrospectively removed by something that happens afterwards. And I think we can also dispose of the argument that this was a case of rampant unilateralism of America and Britain and Australia running wild against the wishes of the rest of the world. It does overlook the fact that nearly half of the current members of the European Union signed a letter of support for the United States, that Japan, Kuwait, Singapore, and a considerable number of other countries also came out in favour of the military action, though they didn't take part in it themselves. And Kuwait was by no means absent. Kuwait allowed its territory to be used as the base from which the operations were launched. It's simply not the case to say that this was an action undertaken without Kuwait. And it's not a unilateral action either. The legal justification that was put forward at the time, and which I'm going to offer to you today, is that legal action was taken not against the will of the Security Council, but because it was authorised by the Security Council, and to uphold the decisions of the Security Council of the United Nations. Now, there's no doubt, and it's common ground between Gerry and myself, that the Security Council of the UN has the legal power to authorise military action. That's quite clearly given to it by Articles 39 to 43 of the United Nations Charter. And it's important, therefore, to understand a little about how the Security Council operates, because this is often misunderstood. The Security Council consists of 15 states. For a resolution to be adopted on an issue of substance, in other words, not a procedural issue like the decision to adjourn for lunch, you need 9 votes out of the 15 in favour. And none of the permanent 5 members, China, France, the Russian Federation, the UK and the USA, none of the P5 must vote against. So you've got a double threshold, a double hurdle to jump. You've got to get 9 positive votes and you mustn't get a veto from one of the P5. Now, because there is that double threshold, you can end up with a number of rather serious consequences. First of all, it's quite possible that the Security Council can be deadlocked and unable to take a decision either for or against a particular course of action. Secondly, it makes it tremendously important to understand that the fact that the Council does not adopt a resolution endorsing something is not at all the same as the Council adopting a resolution condemning it. They're two very different matters indeed. And lastly, it's important to keep in mind that a resolution of the Security Council
doesn't just lapse through the effluxion of time. It remains in force until either the council repeals it by another resolution, or in some cases, if the resolution itself contains a provision stating that it will run only for a fixed period of time, many of them say that they remain in force only for a period of 6 months, that period of time runs out. But none of the resolutions with which we are concerned contain automatic expiry clauses of that kind. They therefore remain in force until such time as they are repealed by the Security Council. Now, Gerry described the British government's view about the cumulative effect of these Security Council resolutions as clever and wrong-headed. Well, that's half right. He also referred to one or two snippets of those resolutions, but I think we need to look at them with a little bit more care. You do need to read them. Very few people have done. Not all of them are a great read, and certainly very few of them are page-turners. But they are important, and they go back to that Iraqi invasion of Kuwait in 1990. Now, we've heard April Glaspie, the American ambassador's name, dragged through the mud again. Poor old April Glaspie. After her stint as ambassador in Baghdad, she went off to be political advisor to the US admiral who was running Somalia at the time that went tremendously wrong. And this is what earned her her nickname in the US State Department, where she's known as Typhoid Mary. I think that maybe where there was a misunderstanding is I don't think April Glaspie meant that an invasion of Kuwait by Iraq would be regarded as an entirely Arab matter. She was referring, and I think it's quite clear if one looks at the whole of the transcript, to two territorial boundary disputes between Iraq and Kuwait, not to the idea that Iraq could march in and snatch the whole of Kuwait. But that, of course, is precisely what it did in the summer of 1990. It invaded Kuwait. It systematically plundered Kuwait. Virtually the only cars that work in Baghdad are ones that were looted from Kuwait after the invasion of 1990. And it proceeded to dismantle everything, right down to the hospital equipment, and ship it back to Baghdad. And it embarked on an occupation markedly more brutal than anything that has been seen in the Palestinian territories since 1967. Now, not surprisingly, the reaction of the Security Council to that and the reaction of the whole international community was about as negative as it gets. The Security Council condemned the invasion as a breach of the peace. It was clearly illegal. Breach of the peace is one of the three terms, along with threat to the peace and act of aggression, that triggers the power of Security Council military action. I think you could reasonably have described this as an act of aggression. But for some reason, the Russian Federation wanted to save that for another day, and so it was changed to breach of the peace. And then a few months after the invasion, in November 1990, the Security Council adopted Resolution 678, which authorized states cooperating with the legitimate government of Kuwait to use all necessary means, which is UN speak for force, to do three things: to liberate Kuwait, to ensure that Iraq complied with all of the relevant Security Council resolutions on Kuwait, and there were quite a number of them even by then, and thirdly, and this is quite explicit in the text of the resolution, to restore international peace and security in the area. Now, that's not verbiage. It's there for a reason, not least because it's the one part of the resolution that really adds something. The governments that used force in 1991 could have done that anyway in the exercise of the right of collective self-defense to liberate Kuwait. Why did they want a Security Council resolution? Partly for precisely this reason, because it could authorize them to do something that self-defense could not achieve, to go beyond simply the liberation of Kuwait. And with great respect to Colin Powell, if he thought otherwise, he was wrong. Now, there's nothing implied in that authorization of military action. It's as explicit as you can get. And the war that followed lasted a matter of a few weeks. By March 1991, Iraq has surrendered and is offered a ceasefire. Now, the terms of that ceasefire, the terms of that cessation of hostilities, are not spelt out in a peace treaty. They're spelt out in a Security Council resolution, which Iraq had no option about accepting. It derives its legal force from the Council, not from the acceptance by Iraq. That's Resolution 687, probably the least page-turning of all of the resolutions I'm referring to. Now, that resolution deals with a great raft of matters, but the important things for our purpose are these. First of all, it makes clear that Iraq was still considered a threat to international peace and security. In other words, even after Kuwait has been liberated, the threat to peace and security in the area has not ended. And that's enormously significant given what 678 authorized coalition states to do. Secondly, the Council sets out in that resolution what Iraq has got to do in order to remove that threat to international peace. And although it laid down a number of requirements, only three of them are really significant for our purposes today. First of all, Iraq was to get rid of all chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons, all components for chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons, and any missiles with a range of more than 150 kilometres. Secondly, it was to stop all research into such weapons. Any programme of research into the development of chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons was explicitly prohibited by Resolution 687. And thirdly, it wasn't enough for Iraq to do this. It had to do it under international supervision so that a UN weapons inspectorate would verify that Iraq had indeed complied. Now, that's very important because the mere fact that Iraq was suspected of having these hideous weapons, and take a look at the photographs of what chemical weapons did in the village of Halabja in 1986, if you're not sure how horrific they are. The mere fact that Iraq would be suspected of still possessing such weapons was destabilizing. If you think back to the events of 1939, when Hitler told the president of Czechoslovakia, either put your country under my supervision or we will reduce Prague to rubble. That's a clear, aggressive threat. It wouldn't have been any less clear or any less aggressive if the next morning Hitler had said to Benesch, by the way, you know, we were joking last night. The Luftwaffe has run out of fuel. We couldn't actually get any planes in the air, so you're quite safe. We just bluffed you. A bluff with chemical weapons is less serious than their actual use, but it's still massively destabilizing in an already unstable region. And that was what Iraq was required to do. And then Resolution 687 does one other vitally significant thing. It expressly maintains in force Resolution 678 and the earlier Security Council resolutions. So far from repealing them, expressly or impliedly, it expressly states that they remain in power. Now, the significance of that became clear in 1993 when Boutros Boutros-Ghali, the then Secretary General of the United Nations, made this comment following an a military action by French, British, and American forces. The raid yesterday and the forces which carried out the raid have received a mandate from the Security Council according to Resolution 678, and the cause of the raid was the violation by Iraq of Resolution 687. That's 2 years after 687 was adopted and 2.5 years after Resolution 678. And the same argument about the revival of the authorization of Resolution 678 was relied on by the British and American governments in 1998. Interestingly enough, when Robin Cook was Foreign Secretary, an argument he clearly found less implausible then than he now purports to do. The problem, of course, was that Iraq never complied with its requirements under Resolution 687. Now, whatever it may have or may not have done with its weapons stocks, it certainly didn't abandon its research programs, and it certainly didn't disarm under international verification. On the contrary, it was caught out cheating so often and making so many final declarations, which in turn were proved to be inadequate, that in 1998, weapons inspectors had to be withdrawn. And here is the real problem, Mr. Chairman. The real problem is that the international community, through the 1990s, never really grappled with what to do about Iraq's failure to comply with what the international community itself had said had to be done if international peace was to be secured. And it's against that background, you have to understand the significance of Resolution 1441, unanimously adopted in November 2002. That resolution reaffirms Resolution 678. There's no other reason for referring to it in the preamble. It's a clear and unambiguous statement that the Council thought the resolution was still in force. It then determined, unanimously, that Iraq had not complied with 687, was still not complying, and was still a threat to international peace and security. That's what the Council decided. No case of a unilateral action here. And then it gave a final opportunity to Iraq to comply, with a very clear statement at the end that if Iraq didn't do so, serious consequences would follow. And that, again, is UN speak for military action. What other serious consequences could there be for a country that was already subject to mandatory and near universal economic sanctions? But Resolution 1441 was not automatic. Paragraph 12 of that resolution provided that a failure to comply by Iraq would be considered by the Security Council. Considered. Now, France and a number of other states had pressed for a different wording. They had wanted a resolution which said the Council shall decide on any further action. But they couldn't get that. And the formula that was adopted instead was the one I just quoted to you. The Council would be required to consider, but not to decide. The significance of that change of wording is considerable, and it was understood by everybody in the Security Council at the time. It meant that if the Security Council was deadlocked, that did not preclude military action under Resolution 678. So what happened then? Iraq still didn't comply with 678, 687, and 1441. You don't have to take my word for that. That was the view the Security Council took when it debated the subject on the 7th of March 2003, less than a fortnight before Dr. Simpson turned 40 and the UK, USA and Australia invaded Iraq. In the course of that debate, the Iraqi ambassador said Iraq has already done everything required of it. Not a single member of the Council accepted that. And 14 of the 15 members of the Council expressly rejected the Iraqi argument. The only state that's ambiguous on this point is Syria, which didn't endorse Iraq's position, but didn't overtly criticise it either. But despite that fact, the Council was not able to adopt either the British draft resolution, which would have authorised military action expressly, but nor would it have been able to adopt a counter-draft, deciding that the inspectors should be left in place for a longer period of time. Neither of those would have got the necessary 9 votes with no veto. It's the classic example of the Council being unable to act. And that is why 1441 was drafted as it was. In the absence of a new Security Council resolution, the only authentic expression of the Council's will was the resolutions it had already adopted. Those resolutions required Iraq to take specific steps in order to restore international peace and security, and made it clear that if it didn't do so, military force could be used against it. That, ladies and gentlemen, was the basis for military action. It wasn't unilateral, it was not in defiance of the Security Council, and it was not illegal. That's why I ask you to endorse the use of force against Iraq. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris. We will now take some questions. Just a moment. As I said, the Laurel Alumni Group is anxious to draw things to a close as we can to 7:30. But within that frame of time, at the close of questions, there will be a couple of minutes of rebuttal by Professor Greenwood, and then another couple of minutes of surrebuttal by Dr. Simpson to draw things to a close. I'm not sure that we need to have a vote on whether or not is illegal. That is a matter of law. So can I take the first questions, and I'm going to take them in groups of three. Gentleman in the red T-shirt in the back.
Professor Greenwood, your argument seems to be that Resolution 1441 essentially, implicitly authorized the use of force by the U.S. and the U.K., and that the fact that they used the word considered rather than decided was a kind of winking on the part of the Security Council to say we're not going to actually, even though they say they're going to remain seized of the matter, that they didn't really mean that, and that in fact they were essentially saying go ahead and build up your troops, take 150,000 or so troops and put them on the border of Iraq, we'll go for a couple of months and put a fake inspection regime in place which we don't expect to succeed. And then when Iraq begins to actually comply by destroying its Al-Samud missiles, over 100 of which in the 2 weeks prior to November 20th, we will again sit back and all along tell you that we've given you the implied authorization to go to war.
With respect, we've had two rambling statements already. If you have a question, could I please ask you to ask it and not treat this like the U.S. Senate where you can filibuster. So if you have a question, please ask it in fairness to everybody else, and there's been a sea of hands down here who also wants to ask questions. Thank you.
Okay. Am I correct in my assumption then that you're saying that they had, that 1441 was an implied authorization of force?
This is to both Professor Greenwood and Dr. Simpson. If we go back to Resolution 687, the operative part of that resolution seems to be paragraph C, to do with weapons of mass destruction. But in essence, the Security Council there has placed two international law treaties to do with bacteriological and toxin weapons conventions on a Security Council resolution. And Professor Greenwood says that this is a threat to international peace and security. How can it be that the internal governments of armaments by a state enforced unilaterally by treaties by the Security Council can possibly be a way of enforcing international peace and security? Or, in essence, what has those treaties or that part of Resolution 687 got anything to do with the invasion of Kuwait? And again, how can there be a link between that and Resolution 678, which authorized the use of force in the 1991 Gulf War?
There'll be another opportunity.
Okay. Dr. Shah Ali, I sometimes despair of the extent of doublespeak coming from Professor Greenwood's side.
With respect, sir, you either ask a question or don't do anything. Do not make a statement. Okay?
I'm going to go on to a question. I
don't think we're here for you to abuse the speakers. Okay.
I don't think it's abuse to refer to a state of feeling, is it, as such?
You just accused the speaker of double speak, so please.
Right. Now, to move on to my question, with a very unbiased chair at the helm.
I would do exactly the same had you abused Dr. Simpson, sir.
Right. Okay. The question is this. Is there not a danger of treating the question as important as it is, of the legal legitimacy of the war, conflating that with the justification for the war? Clearly, were it the case that the war were justified, it could still be. Clearly, were it the case that the war were legal, it could still be a further moral question whether the war was justified. And moreover, if it were the case that the war was illegal, one might find oneself still justified morally to do contrary to what was legal. So I wanted to get a response on that, please. Apologies for any disrespect.
Thank you. Do you guys want to answer the questions?
first of all, this question down here. I was a signatory to a letter to the Guardian just prior to the war breaking out, in which we made a legal argument along the lines of the argument I've made tonight. But at the end of that letter, we inserted a very important clause, which was much debated by the letter writers, to the effect that any Security Council resolution expressly authorizing war, in other words, a post-1441 authorization that didn't in fact transpire, any such resolution wouldn't necessarily lay to rest questions, as I said in my talk, of prudence, strategy, morality, spirituality, or politics. And I think that remains the case. Non-lawyers, and indeed lawyers, are free to debate those issues. Here, I think it's important that we stick to the legal issues, because they're difficult enough as it is, and we have limited time. Very briefly on Security Council resolutions, I don't think we should come away with the impression that the Security Council finds it difficult to take action under Chapter 7. It has done so on several occasions. It's done so in relation to Bosnia, Somalia, Haiti, Iraq in 1990, and Korea in 1950. It does take action. It does pass resolutions referring to necessary measures expressly authorizing the use of force. So we don't have a Security Council that's not working. The Security Council has worked rather successfully in the 1990s. The final point was about the reasoning of the Security Council. I think there is a danger here. The Security Council is beginning to behave almost like a judiciary or a judicial body. And there's a tendency in 687 to make what I thought were legal determinations without sufficient legal reasoning.
Can I take the questions in the opposite order? Start with the gentleman in the gallery. No, that's not at all what I was saying. I certainly don't maintain that Resolution 1441 implicitly authorised military action. Indeed, I don't argue that it authorised military action at all. The authorisation for military action comes from Resolution 678. 1441 is important for a number of reasons, because it determines that there is a breach of 687, and it identifies what consequences will follow if the final opportunity to comply with that is not taken. But it's 678 which authorises military action or nothing. You know, 1441 on its own plainly doesn't do that. Secondly, you made the point that the Council finished off by saying that it would remain seized of the matter. Doesn't that suggest that no unilateral action was possible? It doesn't do anything of the kind. That's a standard form provision where the matter remains on the agenda of the Council. Resolution 678 only has two substantive paragraphs. Well, three substantive paragraphs. One reaffirms the earlier resolutions. The second authorises military action by a coalition that is not under Security Council control. And the third says that the Security Council remains seized of the matter. Now, even though it was an ultimatum, they went to war afterwards without having to go back to the Security Council for another resolution. And it was never thought that that would be necessary. And as for the 150,000 soldiers, well, nobody was in any doubt that that military build-up was going to continue. The Security Council didn't express any reservations about it. And, of course, most importantly, you wouldn't have had 1441, and you wouldn't have had Iraq willing to readmit the weapons inspectors without that build-up of soldiers. The legal obligations on Iraq had been there for years. The second question over here about the treaties that are referred to in Resolution 687. I don't see a problem with that, I must say. The Security Council has a responsibility to take whatever action is necessary to restore international peace and security. Given Iraq's record of having twice invaded its neighbours in the space of the 10 years that Saddam Hussein had been in control, 12 years, and its use of chemical weapons in one of those conflicts, its threat to use chemical weapons in the other, then I don't see any reason at all why the Security Council shouldn't come to the conclusion that the best way of restoring peace and security is to make sure Iraq's never in a position either to use or threaten the use of those weapons again. Now, the fact that it does so by saying you've got to comply with certain international treaties, though it also requires them to go beyond those treaties, seems to me to be entirely commensurate with the Council's authority. And lastly, the point about the danger of treating the question of legality as though it were the same as the question of sort of moral legitimacy, which I think was the essence of what you were saying. I hope I wasn't doing that in what I said. I was talking about whether there was a legal case. I'm a lawyer. I'm not a pope. And there's been a sad decline in the number of popes, as Gary has pointed out. I think it is, at least in theory, possible for military action to be legal but not legitimate. It's possible in theory for it to be legitimate but not legal. But neither of us is making that case on either side of the debate this evening. We were talking solely about legality.
This is probably the first time that Norfolk features in international law discussions. I refer you to the case of Tony Martin, the man who had been burgled many times and eventually was put away for murdering one of the burglars, alleged burglars. Going along with Professor Greenwood's argument that the force was justified, that the use of force was justified, I point out, everyone knows, that Hans Blix was actually saying, yes, they haven't complied, but give us a bit more time and I think they'll come along and they've destroyed some of the missiles. So does Professor Greenwood not think that the war was illegal because it was excessive, it was disproportionate, it wasn't necessary because things were happening from the people on the ground, given the authority in 687 to decide whether the Iraqis were complying, and it wasn't, there was no immediate need for it, so it wasn't illegal, was it not illegal just on that ground? Did anyone hear me? Sorry, that's booming.
Hi, thank you all for the presentations, and I want to preface my question by saying something. I'm not just saying it because I have the two of you for class, but maybe there's a sense in which you're both right. And I'll explain what I mean in the question. The factual predicate for the conclusion that the war was legal was that there was a regime with the weapons capability. And if now we know that that regime is gone and the weapons aren't there, whether the assessment was initially incorrect or whether it's because the regime has been eliminated, does the war, if it was legal before, now become illegal because its factual predicate no longer exists? And if the answer to that question is yes, that the war was legal initially but now is illegal because the facts don't support it, what are the consequences of that?
Thank you. I'd like to throw this question open to both of you, but really, Professor Greenwood, if I follow your reasoning correctly, you're postulating that there was effectively justification for the use of force throughout the whole of the 90s on the basis of Resolution 687 because Iraq was a persistent threat to international peace and security, which was justification for force under 678. If that was the case, why did the US, the UK and Australia feel it was so necessary to go back to the Security Council to seek a further authorization for the use of force? Does that not suggest that they didn't really think that that argument was a particularly strong legal justification? And finally, isn't it the case that on matters of this magnitude that it's either legal or it is not, and that we have to be absolutely certain, and it's for the Security Council to make these decisions, whether the use of force is legal or it's not? And the fact that this appeal for an additional resolution suggests that the legal basis was somewhat questionable.
It's nice of you to, Charlie, put the Pope and Chris and I and Colin Powell all on the same side, but I don't think it can be done. Though I do agree with one thing, and I think Chris probably agrees with this too. I don't think the facts concerning weapons of mass destruction have any effect at all on the legal arguments in relation to collective security. Of course, they'd be hugely important if one was emphasizing the self-defense arguments. If one had to establish that there was an imminent threat from Iraq, then part of that imminent threat would be the possession of these weapons of mass destruction. But with the Security Council, when the Security Council determines something to be a threat to the peace, it is a threat to the peace. The Council could determine this room to be a threat to the peace, and it would be so. It would be pointless to engage in a sociological discussion about whether the room actually was a threat to the peace. That's how the UN Charter is structured. We can't really go behind the Council resolutions, otherwise we'd get into all sorts of trouble.
I suspect we're going to agree on this next point as well. The fact that the Security Council or the United States and the United Kingdom, should I say, tried to get this so-called second resolution after 1441, again, I don't think has any bearing on the legitimacy or otherwise of 1441. I mean, if I believed that the Council had, in effect, authorized an intervention in Rwanda in 1994 through a string of prior resolutions, and the United Kingdom went back to the Council and tried to get a further resolution, then the fact that it didn't wouldn't change my opinion that the prior resolutions had indeed authorized an intervention in Rwanda. So again, I don't think the political failure to get a further resolution has much bearing on our differing interpretations of the three key resolutions, 678, 687, and 1441.
Well, I actually agree with both of those comments. I don't think that the failure to discover weapons of mass destruction retrospectively invalidates military action, but nor am I claiming that the discovery of far more bodies in mass graves than people were expecting retrospectively validates it by some reference to humanitarian intervention. As far as going to the Council and trying to get resolution, and in fact getting resolution 1441 is concerned, first of all, resolution 1441 was, I think, politically highly desirable on any basis because it offered Iraq an opportunity to come into compliance. And I think that was worth doing. In the same way, resolution 678 gave a five-week ultimatum from the end of November to the middle of January 1991 to give a chance to find a peaceful solution. Unfortunately, it wasn't possible to do that. I don't think that attempting to do so, however, suggests that you're unsure of your legal ground or acts to weaken your legal arguments. Now, as for the argument about Tony Martin, or to be more precise, about Hans Blix, that I think is a very important argument, if I may say so. It's worth remembering exactly what Hans Blix was saying at that time. By the beginning of March of 2003, Blix was reporting factually that Iraq had still not done what was required of it. No question about that whatever. He was reporting that he'd made some progress, considerable progress, he thought. Now, that's really the limit of Hans Blix's authority in those circumstances. He's entitled and required to make that call. But the question of whether Iraq is in compliance with Resolution 687 and 1441, that's not for him, and he scrupulously avoided coming down on either side of it. But nor with respect is the decision about whether to let the inspectors stay for longer for him. As we know, what happened is the Security Council couldn't decide either to move to force or to leave the inspectors in place for longer. That's the factual position against which the case for legality of use of force has to be judged.
It's perhaps worth mentioning that Dr. Blix is giving three lectures next week, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday nights at the law faculty at Cambridge. I'm sure you've heard of Cambridge. Those lectures are public. You can find details of them, I think, from the Cambridge Law Faculty website or from the website of the Lauterpacht Research Center for International Law at Cambridge. And those of you that want to take the train up to hear Dr. Blix himself, I'm sure you would find any one of those three lectures to be very interesting. Those are the Lauterpacht Memorial Lectures in memory of Sir Hirsch Lauterpacht, who was a judge of the World Court. We are past the 7:30 point. Can I take just one or two more questions? Diana.
Forgive me, because I'm not legally trained, but I therefore they're genuine questions on the law. Resolution 678, Professor Greenwood, you said authorized states cooperating with Kuwait to use all necessary means, which we know is the jargon for use of force. But that authorization, as far as I can make out, was given to a specific coalition. It didn't give the whole world community the right to use force. So going on, or did it? That's a question. Going on from there to 1441, again, as far as I can make out, That resolution said that Iraq was still not in compliance and was still a threat to international peace. So far, so good. The Security Council has the right to decide that, and whether it's right or wrong is irrelevant to the law. But it then went on to say that Iraq had one last chance to comply or face serious consequences. Now, as far as I can see from that, there are two things went wrong. One is that Iraq was saying that it was complying. The people that were on the ground, namely Hans Blix and his inspectors, said, well, we can't find any WMD, we can't find any research facilities, and we are verifying, so that the conditions for or face serious consequences hadn't happened, hadn't been fulfilled. The Security Council at no point after 1441 came back and said, but we say that you are still a threat, so that condition doesn't exist. And I would also query, Professor Greenwood, excuse me, with my very little knowledge, that serious consequences is automatically taken as meaning use of force. We know that all necessary means are, but certainly Germany, that signed up to 1441, did not believe that it was authorizing the use of force if Iraq did not comply. Nor, I suspect, did France. I was actually in Germany at the time, so I was much more au fait with what was happening. Can you therefore make clear why you think that it was not necessary for the Security Council to reconvene, say that the compliance to the earlier resolution had still not been met, say that all necessary means were required, and also give specific authorization to countries other than a coalition cooperating with Kuwait?
We will use the opportunity to respond to Diana's question for both Jerry and Chris to wrap up what they have said. Thank you.
Shall I go first in that case? Right. First of all, you asked about the provision in Resolution 678 that authorized action by states cooperating with the government of Kuwait. The formula that was used there was used for a very specific purpose. It was designed to ensure that the Council was not declaring Iraq an outlaw which any state was entitled to attack. And to be more explicit still, there was one particular state in the region that might very much have liked the opportunity to attack Iraq, which the Council was quite determinedly excluding from the scope of that authority, namely Israel. But it didn't create a legal person, a coalition, which had to act together in some way or decide matters by majority vote. Any state that fitted the description of being a state cooperating with the government of Kuwait was the recipient of that authorization, not a standing alliance like NATO. And I think that all the three governments that were primarily involved in the use of force in 2003 had all been members of the coalition in 1990 to 91. They had all been expressly invited by Kuwait to take part in military action then, and the government of Kuwait endorsed their action in 2003. So I think that requirement is satisfied. The second question you asked, or the second raft of questions, concerned Resolution 1441. And the question, it comes down really to this. Were the conditions for moving on to the next stage with 1441 satisfied or not? Now, I think with respect, you've turned the resolution on its head there. The resolution doesn't say Iraq is okay unless it is found subsequently to be in breach. What the resolution said is Iraq is already in breach. It is a continuing material breach of Resolution 687. It is for Iraq to satisfy the Security Council that it has terminated that breach. And all I can say about that is that on the 7th of March, which was the last time this was considered,
Not a single member of the Security Council was satisfied that Iraq had met that requirement. So I think that is the proper way to read 1441. And then lastly, the question of whether serious consequences necessarily means military action. I don't think any formula should be read as necessarily meaning military action. You've got to look at the context. I can't at the moment recall the resolution I'm thinking of, but there is one that uses the phrase all necessary means in circumstances where I'm not at all convinced that force was intended. But on the facts of these resolutions, what else could it have meant? Not economic sanctions. We'd already got all those. They'd been there for more than a decade. And while I accept that Germany didn't think it was voting for the authorization of military action, as I say, I don't think 1441 is the authorization of military action. That authorization was already there. It was what could be done with it that 1441 goes to.
The coalition that's referred to in Resolution 678 slowly fractured and fragmented throughout the 1990s. There were several defections from this coalition that had been authorized to use force in 678 in 1991, beginning, one might say, with the French decision not to participate in the later bombings of Iraq in 1998-1999. So it's clear that the two coalitions are quite different. The key legal personality in this discussion is the Security Council. And the various resolutions continually refer to the institutional involvement of the Council in deciding the fate of Iraq and in deciding its own jurisdiction. There is no reference to the key phrase, and I do believe it's a key phrase, and that we need key, clear phrases in these discussions. There's no reference to the phrase all necessary measures. I think as a counterfactual, we only have to imagine the case of China and Russia invading Iraq on March the 20th, 2003, claiming justification on the basis of existing Security Council resolutions. I doubt whether we'd be having this debate today if they had.
Thank you very much, Gary. Well, we have... we have run a little over time, for which I hope David will forgive us, but I think that that reflects the importance of the question, the level, the intellectual... level of the debate and of the spirited nature of your questions. On behalf of my firm and as chairman of the debate, may I thank you all for coming along and making this such an interesting and stimulating but ultimately fruitless occasion. The debate will rumble on for as long, I think, as British troops, American troops and other troops remain in Iraq, and undoubtedly for decades after they leave. Thank you very much for coming. Those of you who have tickets and the Law Alumni group are invited to join a reception on the fifth floor. Would you mind not quite bolting for the door so that Chris and Gary and the people here can get out before... everybody blocks up the entrance. Again, thank you very much for your participation.
Sorry, I'm not trying to get the last word for the debate, but as convener, can I take this opportunity of thanking Ashurst for sponsoring the debate, the Lawyers Alumni Group for organising it, and therefore for fulfilling one of the promises I made when I became convener, which was to give people the opportunity to put the convener on the spot in public on every conceivable occasion. Thank you very much.